This series deals with troubling topics including suicide, drug overdosing, and dependent adult abuse. If you or someone you know is struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, call or text 988 right now and speak with a counselor for free. Previously on The Quarterback and the Con Artist.
Oh, Griffin was the life of the party, you know?
He would just say things that just to be funny, you know, and sometimes they would just be awkward.
And Eric Kramer's son, Griffin, grows up battling all kinds of demons, leaving him isolated and struggling to find true friends.
And I think the inner psychological torture he must have gone through is just heartbreaking.
I mean, friends are everything at that age.
Everything.
Having a group of friends and a social circle and going to parties and being invited, and it's everything.
Everything.
Griffin turns to drugs to cope and then successfully quits. But in late October of 2011, a relapse forever changes the trajectory of his life.
Griffin had already been clean. He hadn't had any drugs in his system or whatever. And this kid shot him up with a dose of heroin.
And he couldn't even inject it himself. He was scared of needles.
Griffin had an immediate reaction to that heroin.
And the drug addict he's with panics.
I think he was more concerned about getting in trouble because he had heroin than he was saving Griffin's life.
I'm Jonathan Walton, and this is The Quarterback and the Con Artist. Episode 4, I'm Paying for It Every Day. Outside a suburban home in Agoura Hills, California, a death investigation is underway. But inside that home, a father is saying goodbye to his son.
He was lying on his back, and that was, and still is to this day, the only dead body I've ever seen.
Eric Kramer tearfully remembers kneeling over the lifeless body of his 18-year-old son, Griffin, realizing there's no going back, realizing Griffin is gone.
It's like reading the last word of a book. It's not like he's going to wake up. And one of the things that kept gnawing at me was, you know, did he really know how much I loved him?
The pain of losing a child is indescribable. And just how 18-year-old Griffin Kramer winds up lying dead on that floor in a house that's not even his is a harrowing tale of gross negligence, ineptitude, and a lack of human decency.
Four teenagers are charged tonight with involuntary manslaughter in connection with the death of Griffin Kramer, a quarterback on the Thousand Oaks High School football team, and the son of former NFL quarterback Eric Kramer.
Those teenagers are the ones in the park witnessing Griffin overdose that night on October 29th, 2011. And instead of calling 911 or taking him to the hospital, one of them puts an unconscious Griffin Kramer in his car and drives him to his own house in Agoura Hills.
Apparently dragged him up to his bedroom at his house, left him there to, quote unquote, sleep it off.
That's Anna Durgan again, Eric Kramer's close friend.
And apparently that's how he had passed away. Instead of them calling 911, taking him to the hospital, there were so many things they could have done.
Oh, the coroner said that they had 11 hours or 9 hours to save him, something like that.
Griffin's younger brother, Dylan.
So they left him, went to a party.
Yeah.
He had skid marks on the back of his head from being drug up a driveway.
And so he would have had to physically drag Griffin,
Eric Kramer,
with his feet or something on the ground, into his house, laid him down on his back, still didn't call anybody, and went out to another party.
And when that 19-year-old gets back from that party, he enters his bedroom and goes to sleep. And he assumes Griffin, lying on the floor, is asleep too. And when he wakes up the next morning, he tries to wake Griffin up. But Griffin is unresponsive. And that's when help is finally called.
911, what is your emergency?
And later that morning, a sheriff's deputy calls Eric and takes him to see his son.
So we drove over there, and Eric was already there.
That's Griffin's godfather, Robert Espinosa, who rushes over as soon as he hears the news.
I walked in the room, and Griffin's laying on the ground, and Eric is at his head, laying with him, just bawling.
Eric holds his son and hugs him for the very last time and says goodbye. It's an extremely difficult moment for him to recall now as he fights back tears.
So I just remember, I don't know, sitting next to him or in some way thinking back about, just things in his life and this is a very horrific day.
A day Robert Espinosa will never forget.
You know, Gershon was my godson, and it was obvious he was passed, and to see your best friend there, just, you don't know what to do. There was nothing I could do. I couldn't console or do anything. It was just very heart-wrenching to see. And then after you hear the details of how it happened and what happened soon after, it was just, man, it didn't have to happen like this. So yeah, it was hard.
The 19-year-old responsible pleads no contest and is convicted of involuntary manslaughter in November of 2012. He gets 5 years probation and 90 days community service.
Eric lost Griffin to the heroin overdose, and I know that caused Eric just unbelievable pain.
NFL writer Tyler Dunn.
That hurt more than just about anything he had been through at that point of his life. And remember, as a football player, he's getting clobbered game in and game out, played through so many injuries and suffered who knows how many concussions, who knows how many subconcussive hits.
Tyler interviewed Eric for his Go Long podcast.
But from what I remember in our conversations, like when he lost his son, that's really what sent him into this spiral mentally.
The death of Griffin Kramer forever changes Eric, and it becomes the first of three life-shattering events that push him to the brink.
He was going through a lot, you know, with his mom and his dad and then his son. It was like this domino effect.
So Griffin dies in October of 2011, and not long after that, both Eric's mother and father die too.
My mom found out she had stage 4 uterine cancer. And then eventually in July of 2012, she passed away. And it was right about that time where my dad had some untreated acid reflux that eventually turned into esophageal cancer. And to see that happen over about a 3-year period with Griffin and then my mom and then my dad, and it was a lot, man. It was a lot of, relatively short amount of time. Just all my attachments were leaving. And there weren't any coming in the opposite direction.
And you were already dealing with depression and stuff for years. Mm. And now it's just like these punches just keep coming.
Yeah. So when depression strikes, it's not like there's a knock at the door or there's not a phone call saying, hey, I'm on my way. It just sort of, there it is. And it, in a very short amount of time, it has you looking through a keyhole and you lose all perspective on what used to be life.
Eric Kramer's 20-year on and off battle with depression, then losing his son Griffin, then losing his mom, and having his dad terminally ill in hospice care. It all conspires to flip a switch in Eric's brain, causing him to put a gun to his head and pull the trigger that day, back in August of 2015. But when Eric miraculously survives, everyone in his life is thrilled, and their guard is down. And that paves the way for a tall, blonde con woman to rob him blind.
That's what's really chilling about this all.
NFL writer Tyler Dunn.
Is you've got somebody who understands what Eric Kramer's going through, seizing upon that to steal hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it just goes to show he needed a hero to kind of swoop into his life. And thankfully, he had one.
Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, mostly because I think dispensaries are a little overwhelming and pretentious. That's just me. You do you. But there's this company called Mood, Mood.com, that's changing the way people can buy cannabis. You know how most dispensaries make you choose between strains with ridiculous names and you have no idea which one's for you? Well, that's what Mood.com figured out. And by the way, you can get 20% off your first order with promo code Walton. If you go to Mood.com and click Shop by Mood, it'll tell you which strain does what. Want to be more social at a party? There's a flower for that. Need to focus and get work done? There's a flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, there's a flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and arrives in a discreet box. Best of all, everything's backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code Walton. So head to Mood.com and get 20% off your first order now. But before we get there, it's important to understand the impact the death of Eric's mom and dad had on him, because his parents were not typical parents by any stretch. They each had a very unusual relationship with their son, hot and cold at times, and very, very nuanced, especially Eric's dad.
The way I would describe my dad, he was well-intentioned, very well-intentioned. But he was not equipped for what he set out to do.
He was very charming, very good-looking. Eric has spit an image of him, but different personality than his dad.
Eric's aunt, Patrice Cameron.
His dad was very ingratiating, very personable, very flirtatious with women. A lot of women fell for him, including my sister, but he wasn't a true husband, let's put it that way. He was a player. But he kind of got by on his looks and charm.
Eric writes candidly about his father, Carl Kramer, in his book, The Ultimate Comeback. At times, it's sad and heartbreaking to read. But other times, it's laugh-out-loud funny. I mean, Eric's dad was a character like none other. Part SNL sketch and part leading man. In the book, your dad comes across as this lovable,
yep,
fun, exciting, hard-driven guy who, I get the impression, half the time you were thrilled he was your dad, and half the time you were not.
I'd say that's pretty accurate. I'd say the thrilled part came more when I was younger. As I got older into my high school years, he was something of an embarrassment.
That's because from the day Eric Kramer is born, on November 6, 1964, in Encino, California, his dad, Carl, is singularly obsessed and driven by an inexplicable sense of urgency to make his son, Eric, a professional athlete.
His father got him at a very, very young age into sports, into football, into baseball, basketball.
Eric's aunt, Patrice Cameron.
Eric's father kind of guided this whole sports thing. He kind of lived through his son to the point of just overbearing and hanging out and trying to influence the coaches.
Looking back, it feels like Eric's father, Carl, knew something that no one else had any inkling of, especially Eric.
Did you become a professional football player because you were so talented and this was clearly what you were meant to do? Or did you become a professional football player because your father literally willed you to be it? You weren't the most naturally gifted athlete on the field, and yet, look at the life you've had.
Yeah.
Do you credit? I guess you got to credit
your dad.
I have to,
yeah.
I mean, he was obsessed.
Without his belief in me, I can sit here right now and tell you none of this would have happened without him having literally blind faith.
I just, reading the book again, it moved me so much to tears in parts. He believed in you so much, it felt to me at times reading, he saw the future and he was just headed for it. He saw your future and he was just pushing you in that direction. It just feels like when you were born, your dad saw a psychic who said, your son's going to be a famous NFL player. And he's like, okay. And then he just tried to make it happen or knew it was going to happen. And it, to anyone looking in the moment, he seems fucking crazy.
And I'm sure I will guarantee you that many people told him, stop.
Oh, I can only imagine.
And you are wasting your time. Well.
Oh, he wasn't.
He wasn't.
Look at the career you've had.
Yeah.
Look at all the teams you played for. Look at all the adventures you had. Look at all the money you made. Like, again, by any metric, you're a huge success. But Eric's road to success and to the NFL is rough and lonely. And the paradox here is that as much as Eric's dad leads him in that direction, the rigor of being led is not without its own trauma and misery. For starters, Eric has a lot of trouble making friends growing up because his dad is obsessively and strategically moving him from school to school to school.
I'm amazed at when I think back of all the schools he went to.
Eric's aunt, Patrice Cameron.
How his father moved him around to these different schools to get him a better chance of playing. I can't even imagine going from school to school as a teenager and ever fitting in. I don't know that Eric ever felt he fit in.
The first elementary school I went to was Melvin Elementary School in Reseda. Then we moved and I went to Fulbright Elementary. I was at Montclair for 2 years, then Valley Christian for one semester, then St. Genevieve for 2 years, then Burroughs for 3 semesters. Like, what the heck is that?
It's a lot of moving around for a kid.
And not in one of those were they in the neighborhood. So with each school, they got progressively further away.
From where you lived.
From where I actually lived, yeah.
You went to a lot of different schools.
Yeah.
Why?
I think this was my dad's progression of how I would get from middle school to high school to college to pro. And he kind of had the map all dialed in.
And was he telling you this at the time?
No.
No. He was just pulling you out of this school, pulling you into that school, pulling you out of this school, putting you into that school.
Yeah.
And most of those schools are relatively small and private.
Competition is tougher in the public schools than it is the private schools.
Eric's aunt, Patrice Cameron.
So he went to a Catholic school and then a Christian school at one time.
So you think that was the calculus? It would be easier for Eric to stand out as an athlete in a private school than a public school?
Possibly.
But I wasn't that good.
Regardless, Eric's dad pushes and pushes and pushes his son to be better. He's at most of Eric's practices and all of his games, and even coaches on some of the teams Eric plays for, while taking copious notes and incessantly drilling his son on technique.
And he was obsessed about teaching certain fundamentals as he saw them to be.
And even when Carl Kramer is not the actual coach at Eric's games, he still tries to be in a roundabout way.
When I was 12 and in a baseball all-star tournament,
Eric is reading now from his book, The Ultimate Comeback.
We were taking pregame infield practice when Dad called me over to the fence. Tell your coach you need to pitch the second game, not the first, he insisted. Why? Because if you win the first game, there's nobody good enough to pitch the second one. Go tell him, now. No, I protested. I'm not telling my coach what to do. You tell him right now, Dad ordered, gritting his teeth and waving his finger at me. Our argument escalated into a humiliating scene in front of my teammates and their parents. I threw down my glove, sprinted to an empty field across the way, and sobbed alone in the dugout. My outburst caused my coach to scratch me from the lineup altogether. There would be no second game for anyone.
It's abundantly clear to anyone watching that Eric's dad is just way too involved and way too invested emotionally in all of his son's sports endeavors, baseball, basketball, and especially football.
His dad believed in him.
Anna Durgan.
Your kids, you live through your kids, and maybe his dad wanted that opportunity. I don't know, but his dad did believe in him more so than anybody else.
More so than Eric believed in himself.
Exactly.
At the time.
Exactly. Well, think about it. Here he is. Carl is shifting Eric from school to school, trying to get him in the, you know, first position of quarterback. Eric became the backup quarterback at John Burroughs High School in Burbank. And then he never really played quarterback at all. He was a safety.
And that's actually when Anna first meets Eric at John Burroughs High School in Burbank, even though it's 25 miles away from where Eric lives in Canoga Park. Eric doesn't qualify to go to John Burroughs. It's out of his district, but his dad gets him in there for a very strategic reason.
We had the best football team in the San Fernando Valley. We went to the CIF champions every year. John Burroughs dominated in football.
And that's why Eric's dad put him there.
Absolutely. And we did go to the CIF championships in our senior year.
And to get Eric into John Burroughs, legally, his dad actually moves him in with a friend of his who legitimately lives in an apartment in Burbank, even though this friend doesn't really have enough room for Eric.
And I basically slept on the floor in the living room on like a sleeping bag.
Wow.
I lived right across the street.
Anna Durgan.
He was only living there to qualify to get into that school that had that football program that his dad thought would be advantageous for his quote-unquote burgeoning career. And that's when you met him. Did you know that's why he was there?
No.
You just thought he lived there?
No, I knew he didn't live there.
Do you know he was sleeping on the floor?
Yeah. Hello. So it was, I was on the floor with him sometimes. But I'm just saying.
After John Burroughs, Eric goes on to attend Pierce College in Los Angeles, playing baseball and football. But then Eric decides to quit baseball and focus solely on football. And his dad does not take the news well.
And he jumped up and put his fist through the drywall.
He punched a hole in the wall.
Upon learning I was no longer going to play baseball at Pierce College.
He was so angry.
Like I was destroying his dream of me playing baseball.
Because in his mind, he wants you to go pro, and he figures this is one less opportunity now.
Right.
Now you're not a baseball player, so we can't pursue baseball.
Yeah.
So Eric's dad sort of doubles down on his football career.
He was a very invasive person. So he didn't just want to come to the games.
He wanted to come to Eric's practices, too. At Pierce College, all of Eric's practices. I mean, these are college-age kids on that field. No other parents are there, but Eric's dad is watching him intently from the stands and taking notes. And Eric begs him, out of embarrassment, to stop coming to his practices. And Carl assures Eric he'll stop coming. But he actually continues showing up, hiding and peeking at Eric practicing from behind a group of trees.
Like, I remember saying to him on more than one occasion, I said, are there any other dads up there that you talk with? Because just so you know, there aren't.
He's by himself.
Which means, like, if you're here, where aren't you? Or at work? So I'm wondering, like, did you even have a job?
Carl went through many jobs. Never could seem to hang on to a job very long.
Eric's aunt, Patrice Cameron.
My sister was busy keeping a roof over their heads, really. She worked, she had the full-time job.
Was she the breadwinner of the family?
Yes, she was.
Wow. Growing up, Eric doesn't realize that his dad is frequently unemployed. But looking back, it's obvious.
So I was a latchkey kid, right? So I remember there was many times, like in the summer, I'm just at home, and he'd come home. And he'd take the phone off the hook, and he said, if your mom asked, tell I wasn't here.
Eric witnesses a lot of stuff like this growing up with his mom and dad.
Spending most of his time hiding.
From her?
From her.
Yeah.
Or whatever he's doing, he's hiding it from her.
Because Carl Kramer was more often than not in between jobs.
I just don't think he had a good work ethic.
Eric's aunt, Patrice Cameron.
He would get these sales jobs. He had one good job with a sprinkler manufacturer, but he was more of a friend to this owner. And the owner was older, Carl was young and good looking, and so they kind of palled around together. And so he paid Carl very well. But then the business went belly up, and then Carl had to go find a regular job, which he went through many. But with a sales job, you get a little stipend or something before, you know, you get for a couple of months. And then if you don't produce, they let you go. So that kept happening. But I don't think, if it didn't come easy to him, I don't think he pursued it. So my sister could never depend on a salary from him. Not that he wasn't capable of it. I just think he didn't particularly want to work a 9-to-5 job. His focus was Eric and guiding his success through sports.
Sadly, though, by the time Eric makes it to the NFL,
Kramer hit him on a perfect pass.
He and his dad are becoming distant. In 1991, Eric is playing for the Detroit Lions, and in the midst of leading the Lions to a huge victory over the Dallas Cowboys, I mean, Eric is on fire during this game.
Drive, Eric Kramer back, looking, finds Willie Green, touchdown, 32
throwing guided missile precision passes.
Kramer, 341 yards on the day, 3 touchdowns, unbelievable.
When the Lions win, everyone in the sports world is celebrating quarterback Eric Kramer, and he's riding high when all of a sudden,
I get a phone call from Bill Keenest, who was the media relations director.
Apparently, Eric's dad, who he hasn't spoken to in a while at this point, contacts Pat O'Brien at CBS Sports with a juicy story that while his son, Eric Kramer, is out becoming an NFL superstar, his dad is claiming to be homeless. The Lions media director tells Eric that
apparently, your dad is living in the garage of a high school football coach and is making it look like you have abandoned him.
And that's exactly what Eric's dad tells CBS Sports. And Eric is just stunned. I mean, he's at the pinnacle of his career, on the heels of a celebrated victory over the formidable Dallas Cowboys, just one win away from making it to the 1992 Super Bowl, and now his dad is grabbing news headlines for being homeless and abandoned.
That was something I had to deal with.
Because you bailed him out a lot out of things. You gave him money to save his house, mm-hmm. but then he used it on something else and lost the house anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It takes Eric years to build back a meaningful relationship with his father after that, but he does. And near the end of his dad's life, the two get closer than they've ever been. And Eric uncovers a lot of stuff about his dad's upbringing that he didn't know. And it helps him understand why his father was the way he was.
The unfortunate and the tragic part about my dad's life was that his own mother left when my dad was right around 2 years. And so apparently when my dad's mom left, his dad shipped him off to grow up with my dad's aunt's family in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
And as you can imagine, baby Carl Kramer is not a priority for that family.
So not only had he been abandoned by his mom, not only had he been abandoned by his dad, the dad he did grow up with wasn't a dad. The mom he grew up with wasn't a mom.
So Eric's dad, as a child, is raised in relegation, always feeling like an outsider, always feeling like he doesn't belong, always feeling less than. And learning all of this profoundly changes Eric's understanding of his father.
My recollections of my dad, I have to now put that into context.
Doesn't that just freaking explain everything?
It does.
How could he have been any different?
Yeah, it couldn't have. And so, you know, nobody comes out of the womb, good or bad. They just come out. We're all given the capacity. Most everybody wants to be good, but is the family you're coming into set up for you to help get there, you know? And in his case, no. My dad was passionate, well-intentioned, loving in a way that he knew how to be. He was also flawed, but it wasn't like he was shown the ABCs of life by anybody. So it was, for him, make it up as you go and do the best you can with what you've got.
But as unconventional as Eric's relationship with his dad was, his relationship with his mom was equally unusual in a whole other way.
So my mom, for me, was mostly somebody I feared.
Which is odd for a son to say about his mother.
I wasn't really close with her growing up. She didn't craft out a bunch of time for me. You know what I mean? I don't remember her and I going anywhere together. I think for my mom, it must have felt for her like a prison sentence.
Like she did something wrong and now she's here.
Yeah. Like she made one bad choice. And now I'm paying for it every day.
If you or someone you know is struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, call or text 988 right now and speak with a counselor for free. If you're enjoying The Quarterback and the Con Artist, click that share button right now and text it to your friends and family. And if you can, leave us a 5-star review. The Quarterback and the Con Artist is produced, written, and hosted by me, Jonathan Walton, for Jonathan Walton Media. Executive producers Eric Kramer and Anna Durgan. Audio engineering by Justin Longerbeam. Editing and sound design by Hansdale Shi. Legal counsel provided by Ken Sterling from Sterling Media Law. We've got a lot of incredible stories in the works at Jonathan Walton Media, so make sure you subscribe and keep an ear out.